This is Dialogue Radio 57 WMCA right here in New York City, and this is the Long John Neville Candy Jones Show. And we're talking with Gene Shepherd. Now, I've known Gene for just about 20 years. And we were both sort of hanging around WOR at the time. And Gene was doing a show from 11:15 to 11:30, and then I came on from 11:30 to 12, which is a show, well, it wasn't heard by many people, and at that time, Gene was talking about jawbreakers and...
tongue-in-cheek and putting them down, actually.
That's true, but...
you know, the whole point, the reason I did this stuff, I used to say things like, you know, it's funny how people take you seriously. I'm a kind of a deadpan comic, and on the air I used to say, things like, it's just really sad to realize that so many of us, our tastes were formed forever by root beer barrels. And,
well, I enjoyed them. What's wrong with those? Don't put them down.
I always shepherd,
you know, this is my show. Don't put down root beer barrels. They're absolutely fantastic.
Well, I always thought that they were promoted by the American Dental Association. That contributed more to
Kelly's
teeth rot than anything.
If I have the album. But I'd like to have you do one head thumping thing for us tonight.
Gee, I haven't done that in a couple of years.
You think your head is out of tune?
Oh, no. I always keep my head. This is a lifelong habit.
Well,
I like Sherlock Holmes when I'm deeply involved in evolving some really deep concept.
What kind of music?
In my head.
What if we have that great tenor man from the world's greatest jazz band?
Who was that? Was that...
I can't think of his name at the moment. You've got to have something that's really...
It's Yank Lawson's band.
Yes. Great tenor man.
Yeah, he was.
And if he's listening, he's out of his bird right now that I can't think of his name.
It's the worst thing to have happen, you know, to be driving along and some guy can't remember your name. He says it was Long John something. It's on the tip of my tongue. Was it Long John Bibble? No. Ishka Bibble? No.
That's really a killer.
You know, John, I must say, I've listened to your show lately. I was on one of those rare occasions when I could get gas in my car. I was driving over in Jersey one night after leaving a friend of mine, and I turned on the radio, and there you were. Oh, it must have been 2:33 in the morning. And I must say, John, coming out of that receiver I had there, that your acerbic wit has never left you. If anything, it's meaner than ever.
Thank you very much. That's a high compliment.
In fact, you were making coleslaw of some guest that night.
Yes.
And I was sitting in the car laughing because he didn't know you were doing it. And you were just chopping him up, and you were about to put the mayonnaise on him. And it was great to hear a pro at work, you know.
No, we still do that if we feel that the guest is entitled to that treatment.
Well, he did. He had it coming. He was a pompous one. He made Al Lotman seem modest.
Do you remember who it was?
No, I don't. I just remember you, John, saying, well, on the other side of the picture, he said, I'm going to take... And I could hear the guy sitting there and wheezing away. You were landing on him. But do you ever see any of your old compatriots, the Brooklyn Barber?
No, I haven't seen the Tom Sawyer-Lytus from Brooklyn for a number of years.
I miss Howard Menges and all those.
Howard Menger.
Menger.
Well, he's in Florida someplace developing a new craft, which the plans were given to him by a Venusian who spent about 3 days at his home in Florida.
Well, they do that. They spend a lot of time down at his retirement homes.
So, this keeps going on. A lot of people ask for some of the old shows to be replayed, and I have a big stock of them here. But unfortunately, we haven't had editing time because there's station IDs and things like that. And we have
what was his name? The science fiction... The guy
Lester Del Rey, Lester. The Magnificent.
Yeah, Lester. Is he still around?
Oh, yes. Lester's with us, and Fred Pohl is with us, and Sandy Teller. And all of those major names in broadcasting are still around, I'm delighted to say.
A ponderous crew.
Candy, did you ever hear Mr. Shepard do head thumping?
Do what?
Well, I'm not going to tell you anymore. I'm not going to tell you anymore. And if you'll be kind enough to talk with Shep for a couple of minutes, I am going to go out and look through my albums because I want you to hear. This is absolutely fantastic. If I can find the album that I want. So, will you bear with me a moment?
Did you say something about head thumping?
Head thumping.
Okay. You're going to look for head thumping?
Actually, he was able to get some of his instructions through the head of the percussion department of Manny's Music Shop, Danny Bergauer.
Danny's worked with me by the hour.
That's right. And he also is a magnificent man on the jawharp.
The jawharp?
The jawharp.
Well, it's actually the Jew's harp.
Oh,
that
yeah.
Used to be, but
why do they call it jawharp now?
Well, I don't know. We had certain complaints that came in from...
that's like calling an English horn something else.
That's right.
What's the matter with that?
Call it a German.
A French horn now becomes an Algerian plural one. I mean, it's kind of strange. You know? In fact, you know, it's getting to me today that if you even mention a nationality on the air without saying anything about it at all, just mention it. You get five angry letters.
You have to.
That's right.
Five people pick at you.
That's right.
I mean, all you have to do is say something like, Belgian.
Yeah.
And seven guys say, what was that you said last night? And it's just...
You know, we had a letter that came in with... I was quoting from a review from the New York Times book review section, mm-hmm. quoting a man's... about a man's book, and I... had the review, and I said, I quote, and I read the quote, unquote. And a letter came in, well, it was directed to the head of the station, in which it said that I had said the quote. It was my personal interpretation. The quote was obviously not that flattering, but it was a whole series
yeah.
of things. And then...
well, it was about Anne Frank.
The Diary of Anne
the
Frank.
The Diary of Anne Frank. And, when that was produced on Broadway, the gentleman who wrote the book and had collaborated with the father of Anne Frank, the people who produced it, Kermit Bloomgarden, and
Lillian Hellman,
who was involved as the show doctor and all, they indicated that they felt that the manner which he had written it, the author, Meyer Levin, that it was, and these are quotes, too Jewish. And some, I'm not sure if it was a lady or a gentleman that wrote in, and naturally they only listened with half an ear and indicated that it was an anti-Semitic remark. Well, it wasn't, because this is the review in the New York Times about his book, The Obsession. And he has written a book. Actually, Meyer Levin is a very fine writer. He did Compulsion, and we've had him on a number of times. But he is very peeved, and he feels that Anne Frank's father sold out, and therefore it should be litigated. The... he feels that he should be brought to the halls of justice.
Right.
Not Meyer, but Anne Frank's father.
Now, I know that today it's... I think there's a great sickness that's traveling around the world, and it's a kind of sickness that... that really, in a sense, says that my desires and what I need are the most important things in the world. If you don't accept that, I'll kill you, or in words to that effect.
Yeah, and the terrible thing is that people are doing that.
Well,
they
sure
they
are.
Go right out and they kill the situation.
Well,
this,
first.
Yeah, exactly.
Classic example.
$70 for every person who's on...
Well, I'm just curious where we're headed. I think that I was thinking about that coming down here tonight. I was walking along 57th Street, and it just hit me. I don't know why I thought this. I don't know whether other people think like this. But, it just hit me. I was walking across 7th Avenue, and it suddenly hit me. I saw paper swirling along 57th Street. It used to be an elegant street, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this, there's a restaurant all boarded up, and it's kind of looking real sad and defeated. And in the window is an old Kew review of their past glory. You know, they were depressing.
Yeah.
And it suddenly hit me. I thought to myself, well, you know, I wonder if a lot of us who are alive at this time are aware that we could be at the end of a great era. In other words, civilization is over.
I don't think you're alone.
And we're beginning a new age of barbarism. In other words, the barbarism of the early days, one of the things that set the barbaric peoples apart, I'm talking about back in the very, the really, the age of barbarism, Attila the Hun, and the great ages of the conquerors, was that a country would run roughshod over other countries.
Mm-hmm.
A leader would run roughshod over another country or another people. And I wonder whether or not we're getting into that again.
Well, when you think of the situation with the Getty boy, for example, the cruelty of cutting off an ear and
That's the kind of thing that would have happened in Attila the Hun's day.
Of course.
Sure.
They used to send back a limb.
And remember, this is in a comparatively civilized country. This is Italy.
Right.
This is not happening in some backwater, savage part of the world.
But you know, this request in which, and I have not really read the papers for today, which is what, Wednesday already? Yeah, Wednesday. I just saw the headline, and I heard a little bit of it on the news as we were getting ready for the show and ready to welcome the Great Shepherd. But the $70 requested for each person, each poverty person who was a poverty case in the state of California, and they were going to keep her until this would be accomplished, and then they would start to negotiate. I just wondered if the... Oh, and this happened. This is what I started to say. This happened in Argentina. They had the same thing with a... I believe it was a similar group in Buenos Aires.
Oh, sure. This has happened.
In which they asked... This is
and
not...
they paid. There was a... You're talking about an executive...
Ford Motor Company.
Well, this is a kind of... a cosmic, barbaric lawlessness that's going through the world. And, of course, it's all done with a great air of righteousness. It's not done with... it's always done with... we're trying to clear up the evil in the world. That's why we've captured you and we're killing you.
Yeah. They say that she is being kept under the conditions of the Geneva Peace Conference, or the Geneva Peace... Yeah. What was it, conference?
Well, when in doubt, always trot out a great cliche about peace. This is an old slogan among radical groups, and it persists. I'm just curious because we see this now today with the oil nations are again they're doing it. This cosmic blackmail.
Mm-hmm.
They happen to have a considerable amount of the world's oil under their soil, so they're in effect blackmailing the rest of the world to believe what they believe or back their causes, or else they pick up their marbles and go home.
Well, so I think they're going home.
I just wonder whether the reaction to this could be a return to the old days of imperialism. In other words, it's even been implied where certain countries have implied and veiled. Not us. We haven't said this yet.
You're talking about France?
Well, not only France, but I think it was also said by a couple of British statesmen,
mm-hmm.
where they implied that ultimately, to preserve the world, ultimately, military intervention, maybe. This is the kind of thing that they had back in the 18th and 19th centuries, where a country would go into another country merely to keep the peace of the world.
Yeah.
And I just wonder where it's all heading. It'd be fascinating.
I don't know whether it's fascinating. It is, sure, it's fascinating.
Well, it's historically fascinating, Kenny.
No.
You know, it just...
How could we go backwards in civilization?
Well, because I think we always do. You know, that see, Americans aren't much hip on history. We think history is reading about the Civil War. And that's only 100 years ago or so. That's not history to most other places in the world. That's recent events. And it always comes as a surprise to a lot of Americans to realize that there have been periods in the world, thousands of years ago, where civilizations were at a very high peak and then declined.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to go through those cycles. Of course, I suppose at any given time, if you're living in one of those societies, it's impossible for you to conceive of it declining.
Exactly.
I can't imagine a guy walking around the streets of Athens in the age of Pericles looking around and saying to himself, well, one day this shall all be ruined and I'll be selling postcards.
Right.
And this will be a grubby little tourist haven and the Greek civilization will have disappeared practically. He couldn't see that, and we can't either. We can't see this.
Yeah.
It's difficult for us to see that maybe 4,000 years from now, 4,000, I said, people will slowly begin to be coming out of another great dark age, and they will look back on our time as we look back on the age of the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
There's a period when people wrote books and people read and people, as you notice, there's an advancing illiteracy in the world.
That's true.
Now my book here, I've been shocked ever since I've gotten really seriously into writing in the last 10 years, Candy, to realize how few people actually read.
What
can we read?
Well, and yet book sales, paperback sales, are up
books.
Tremendously.
See, I'm going to tell you, they're not, they're what the industry calls non-books. They're sex books, they're how-to books.
Well, the how-to book is not a book.
That's called a non-book.
That's a non-book, right. But non-books sell, cookbooks, non-books,
yeah.
Right. What is a sex book?
Well, Dr. Rubin.
Yeah, that's a non-book.
That's
too.
A non-book.
Right.
And of course, the fiction itself, and I'm a fiction writer, you rarely hear fiction people, for example, even being interviewed on television. You'll not see Philip Roth on TV, but you will see some guy who's written a cockamamie little book on how to cheat on your taxes.
We had him on.
Yeah, that guy. This is all a sign of an advancing, curious kind of illiteracy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I taught here about 3 years ago. You remember, John, when I was teaching at NYU?
Yes, I do.
And I was astounded to find people in my classes. I had 95 people, and they were all going for advanced degrees, many of them for their doctorates. How many of them had not read classical pieces of literature, which I would mention in class? Like I asked the class if any of them had read Nathaniel West. Two hands went up. These are people that are going to be teachers. I got a letter the other day from a kid, by the way, who had read, by the way, was trying to do a book review on Wanda Hickey, this book John has right here.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, my teacher, who teaches English over here in Clifton High School, Clifton, New Jersey, he said, I wanted to review your book. And so apparently they have to get prior permission of the teacher to come here. And she said, well, I never heard of him. And he says, well, he's written a lot of books, and he's in magazines, and he's so forth. She says, well, I haven't heard of him. He says, well, then can I do a book review on H.H. Monroe, the famous short story writer of the 1920s, World War I period? And she says, well, look, she says, I don't know who this man is. He finally tried to get her to approve Thurber, and this woman had never read James Thurber, had heard his name.
She'd never even...
That's right.
Impossible.
It's a common... No, it's not impossible. It's a common problem today. And
well, how do they get to be teachers?
Well, because a number of things. A lot of people get a lot of their education today through films. They don't read much. They read a lot of workbooks. They read a lot of survey courses. But to actually read a book is a real chore to many people today. And this is a sign of, I think, a real interesting sign. And so you'll notice that the increasing violence on television, you can hardly turn on any television show today without hearing the sound of gunfire and the thunk of karate and then the screams of sirens, no matter what the show is about. So,
saying that sound is a very big thing.
Oh, yes.
Too.
The love of violence, the love of mass movements, you find in our time the great mass movements, the great Dylan crowds, the great Woodstocks. This is all a sign of a curious herd barbarism, merging the South into a kind of a orgiastic whole. Which is very, very barbaric and
reminiscent of what had happened in times long gone.
That's right, when the great Mongol hordes had come streaming down out of the mountains. And I seriously feel that history will be looking back. There will be a Gibbon eventually. There will be a Gibbon, and he will maybe 1,500, 1,000 years from now will begin to write about this great age, which began, I would say, probably around 1300, the year 1300. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
go back that far.
I think the age that we're living in began about 1300. This was when the first signs of literacy began to grow, and the monks began to gather knowledge and so on. And then the Renaissance, of course. And then the great age of reason, and now we're living in the age of Marcus Welby. And God knows where we go from there.
My name's Long John Neville.
I'm Candy Jones.
And our guest tonight is Gene Shepherd.
I wish you could have said Mickey Mouse.
Why?
Our guest is the original Mickey Mouse. He's here tonight. He's brought Minnie with him.
Double M?
No, I just wish that we could have, sometimes occasionally have really exciting guests. You know, the guest syndrome is so much with us today in television and radio. Wouldn't you love to have Donald Duck as a guest?
I think that's Donald Bain you're talking about.
No, I mean the real Donald Duck. I mean, some great character out of American mythology. For example, it would be
Sneezy,
yeah. Or have, say, for example, Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
Remember Pluto?
Oh, I love Pluto.
Yeah, and
I like Sandy.
Sandy? Well, yeah, he had very limited vocabulary. He didn't have much of a role. He was always just standing there going, "Arf."
Are you still doing the Ovaltine bit?
Oh, no. I don't do bits really like that, John. You know, it's funny. That damn thing has pursued me, John. I one time talked to a famous violinist, Isaac Stern. And every time he goes anywhere, somebody insists that he plays the same thing that he once played years ago in a concert. And they love it. And that particular bit, which is really a short story about discovering, you know, most of our literature is about discovering sex, as you know, the Graduate, the Philip Roth story, Portnoy Complaint. But my feeling is that Americans have long since outgrown the Freudian problem. And that there are many things we discover in our lives which are equally traumatic, if not more so, than sex. And one of them is to discover that things are not what they're advertised to be. And when you're 16 and you're walking past a used car lot every day and you see this magnificent Ford Fairlane sitting there gleaming, and you go past it week after week after week, and you begin to lust for it with a fantastic, uncontrollable lust. And you get a job in the bowling alley, and you get a job working in the A&P in the checkout line. You save every cent. And 2 years later, you finally get on a friendly Fred, the hungry Armenian, the man standing there with those chrome teeth smiling. You walk in and you put your dough down, you drive it out, and 20 minutes later you discover you have bought a silly putty transmission. And it has a balsa wood differential. You go over your first set of railroad tracks and the frame is a U-shaped frame. You're looking in the back window of the car as you're driving. This is a trauma you do not forget. All of your life, you will wake up with cold sweats at 3 in the morning, remembering how that car went over those railroad tracks and how those shock absorbers bottomed out. And that great cloud of smoke behind you. With these noxious fumes, you get maybe 2 or 3 gallons of oil to the mile. And these are traumas. I mean, and Freud never knew about them. He never knew this kind of a trauma. And a guy from that day on looks at many things with a jaundiced eye. He does. And he can't ever go back again. Thomas Wolfe was right. And that little Orphan Annie thing is about a kid. And we've all lived it. See, the Orphan Annie thing, I think you can tell the age of a person by whether or not he exclaims over the frame of the painting, Candy,
mm-hmm.
or the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And most people who hear that story, if they're of a certain age, they begin to immediately reminisce about Orphan Annie, missing the point of the story.
Mm-hmm.
The point of the story was a kid who every day listened to the radio. Now, it could be watching television. It could be reading Playboy.
And it was that moment of, who's that little chatterbox?
Well, that wasn't the moment. The moment was when he felt that he was not in. If you recall, every day he would sit there and they would come on at the end of the show. And they would say, and now it's time for a secret message to the members of the Little Orphan Annie secret society. Now, at this point, now it's going to see immediately you're getting nostalgic. This is not what it's about.
No, but I wanted to be one of the members.
Well, who doesn't? As a matter of fact, every Playboy reader wants to become a Playboy type, and they buy a little bunny to put on the back of their board, you know. And they put it on their false Hollywood pipes and stuff. And somehow the idea that the Hefner and all the boys of Playboy lived in this strange wonder, it's like living in Oz. When you read the Oz stories, you wanted to be in Oz, didn't you?
Sure.
All right. And so we all had this desire. And so that's what that story's about. It's the desire to be in something.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the show, this announcer would come on. He'd say, all right, boys and girls, set your decoder pin at B7. So now, before we go any further, I'd like to say that any of you who would like to become a member of Little Orphan Annie's Secret Society, send in the silver inner seal from a can of Ovaltine, the rich, chocolatey drink.
Pierre André.
And now here is the message. 7/22/1908. Well, when this thing goes off, and you're living in a non-Ovaltine drinking neighborhood, and you have the sense that out there in the darkness, millions of kids are decoding, getting the real message. And all you can do is go in the kitchen, make a salami sandwich, look out in the darkness, where you see all these cross clotheslines of the depraved Midwest. You begin to fester. You want to. That's the first learnings within a kid to climb out of his level of society, to move upward. And this kid, one day, comes home from school and listening to this show for weeks, and he's walking down an alley. They had alleys in Chicago and still do, by the way, John. I don't know what an alley is in New York.
No, they don't.
But an alley is a curious street behind the house, for any of you who don't know what an alley is. And it's usually covered with garbage. And the kid's walking along, and he's kicking tin cans, carnation milk cans. You know, you go through a period when you're about 10, when you're totally alone. Yeah, you begin to suspect that girls really are different. And it's exciting. He's walking along and he sees an unbelievable sight there in the middle of a bunch of thrown out stuff, old tires, bed springs and garbage and potato peeling, coffee grounds, is an Ovaltine can. The first one he's actually seen. He looks at the can, picks it up, and whoever had bought the can had pushed the silver inner seal, just pushed it down, used the Ovaltine, threw the can out with the seal. Talk about rich. Threw the seal away. Picks it up. Takes the seal out. Goes home. Writes a letter to Little Orphan Annie. Encloses the silver inner seal. Says, Little Orphan Annie, I always drink Ovaltine. I want to be a member of the secret society. Here is my silver inner seat. And sends it to Checkerboard Square, which incidentally is another great American religious location. And all of us secretly would like to spend a week at Checkerboard Square or Battle Creek. In the actual, on the hallowed ground where Mr. Post invented grape nuts. Which has changed the lower colon of many an American. And the kid sits there and sends off the letter. And then begins one of the great travails of his life. Waiting. 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 Almost everything important in your life involves a period of almost unbearable waiting. And he waits and waits, and every day the mailman walks by. Once in a while he comes up, delivers stuff, puts it in the mailbox. It's always marked occupant. The old man takes a look at one of those occupants. I always remember looking at the occupant one, and he tears it open. It says, you need $300 on your signature only. You need no co-signers. And he hurls it down, and he says, how the hell did they know? They don't even know my name, and they know I'm in trouble. Occupant. They're all in trouble, friends, out there in the howling darkness of the night. And he, day after day, waits. And one day, the mailman comes up the walk and delivers a fat, lumpy letter with his name on it. Lumpy. You could feel bumps in it. And it's exciting just to feel it. Even to this day, John, I get excited when I get a letter that has lumps in it. I tell you, something rattles when you know. And he picks it up and rattles. And he goes in the house and he carefully opens it. And he dumps it out on the dining room table with the lace tablecloth. You know, the one with the orange cut glass bowl with the wax fruit. The orange bowl, which was Hollywood pearline ware, which came from the Orpheum Theater, shakes it out, and there is his membership card in gold. It said to be a member for life and to be given all the rights and honors accruing thereto. Member of the Orphan Annie Secret Society, Gene P. Shepherd, signed in ink by Pierre Andre. Membership card, the first one. And the first membership card you get in your life is even more traumatic than your first sexual experience, really, in America today. Freud would have known about this. Many guys today collect yards of these things, keep them in glass envelopes, diners, clubs, carte blanche. American Express. I have a Diners Club card that I treasure. I go to the meetings over at the old Diners Club. We sit around and talk about Howard Johnson, all the greats in American Diner Club history. and he gets this membership card, and what made it so sweet was because it was the most beautiful kind of card to own. It was in. But what made it even better And in the true American tradition, he was a phony. He was a non-Ovaltine drinking member. Which, I mean, the illicit is always much more fantastic than the licit. And then he shakes the envelope again, and out comes his secret decoder pin with simulated gold knob. And he's ready. And that night, he listens to the adventure, you know, the whole business Joe Cointassel. They're chasing the smugglers. And all, you know, let's get back down to the nitty-gritty. And finally, on comes Pierre Rondeau, and he says, "Boys and girls, here's tonight's message for the members of the Little Orphanetti Secret Society. All set now. Set your pins at B12. Ready? Take this message down. 9. 13. 4. 36. 12. He could get more out of numbers than Orson Welles could get out of King Lear. 3. 22. 8. And the kid's writing it down. And he finally finishes off and says, "All right, boys and girls, there's your secret message. Don't forget tomorrow, this same time at 5:15, when the Little Orphan Annie Secret Society meets once again, when you hear the song, 'Who's That Little Chatterbox?'" And he, the hell with this. And he runs. He's got the message. His first message. Where do you decode? This is secret. So he goes to the only room in the house where a boy of 9 can decode in privacy. Locks the door. And begins to decode. 4. Moves the knob. After it's been set at B12. 4. Let's see. B. Writes down the letter B. That's the first letter, B. 17. E. B-E. That's a word. B. 34. S. 9. U. Be sure. R. R. E. Be sure. 19. T. 18. O. 3. D. 12. R. I. N. K. O. V. A. L. A crummy commercial. Be sure to drink Ovaltine. From Little Orphan Annie herself. And at that minute, the scales begin to slowly fall from the eyes. That the world was never again quite the same.
Beautiful.
Yeah, thank you, Jim.
Beautiful, Jim. Gene,
I haven't done that in 5 years.
That's beautiful.
You and I are going to leave you here alone with your head. Now, are you in tune?
Are you going to I'm always in tune. A really dedicated head player for your information, Candy. It's called Kopfspielen. It's originally an Austrian form of musical expression. And the head thumpers, throughout history, have been rather covert about their work, often apologetic. And from I'm serious. And from the age of 5, I personally have kept my head in good shape. I wear a beret every night when I sleep, soaked in neat's foot oil. And otherwise, an untreated head tends to become dry, millions of tiny cracks, and there's a mushy tone. And I have a C melody alto head, which is one of the rarest. Yes. And fortunate. I'm telling you the truth. When you hear it, you'll know what we mean. So I don't like to perform on the head to people who take it lightly. It's a serious, it is a serious musical expression. And in fact, I did this one night, and I've got a secret. I performed, let's see who was on it that night, Betsy Palmer, Henry Morgan, and I did it with the Irving Fields Quartet. You might have seen the show, yeah. It was a wild show. It was repeated many times. They used to use that tape over and over again. Gary Moore was on the show in those days. And I have one of the few people who've actually worked as a professional head thumper. I'm listed in Local 802. And my instrument is the head.
He's not kidding.
I'm not kidding. I'm
no,
serious.
This is very...
And you know how they got to me? I've got a secret. 802 called me. You're the only one listed in all of New York City. And I said, well... Okay. And so I appeared on I've Got a Secret, and I've done it in two reviews. I did this in a review down in the Orpheum Theater on 2nd Avenue, a review. Do you remember? You know the theater down there, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, this was a show that was produced, believe it or not, by Jerry Kretschmer, the Environmental Protection Agency guy. And Jerry was a producer.
Sure has changed.
Oh, no, he's still on showbiz. Jerry hadn't changed at all. He's just gotten louder. But Jerry produced this show, and I performed every night. A rousingly successful show. John remembers the show now, man. And I performed with a band the whole bit.
I can't wait.
Wait a minute. I think because you can't hear this way, I think, is the monitor open in the... I think what we should do, because you want to watch him. And I think we should do, Candy. I'll give you a cue, which my engineer will see. Actually, we're very fortunate to have an album by Marion and Jimmy McPartland. And the number is Avalon. No, the other side for you to adjust. You want to get levels or anything?
Yeah.
Could you just give us maybe about 8 bars? You want to hear 8 bars?
I just want to get a little more level here.
Play a little bit first.
Okay.
All right. Put it up at the top. Recue it. And because we want to watch you.
Okay. Now he's better. He better get a level on my head here. All set?
Do you want to get a level on his head? You hear?
Okay.
All right.
Give me just a little touch of that echo chamber, okay?
We will. You can direct the engineer.
I certainly will.
We will be out there watching you.
All right. I've had experience here, John. All right.
Thank you very much.
All right. Cut the echo for a second here until John gets back into his... Now, the reason we use an echo chamber here is not because... our head is not properly tuned for non-echo work, but it gives a nice effect for those who like the more rococo in music. All set? And when you start the record, immediately go into that little echo, and I'll be ready to go. Okay? Go. done that in a long time. How'd that sound in there? Oh, no, no. No headache. Not to a properly trained head. I feel like a tap dancer on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Absolutely.
Hey, you.
Absolutely.
Haven't done that since I was on the air with you the last time.
That's right. We had Bud Friedman with us that.
Yeah.
She's looking at your head.
And well, she might.
That is just great. Now, if anybody thinks that's a put-on, you're 100% wrong. Now, we had a sit in what's called a sponsor's booth so we could listen and actually see Gene work. Now, that is possibly the only man, to my knowledge, in America who's doing head thumping.
Well, serious head thumping. A lot of guys, you know, fool around with it. But we are a very tight community, head thumpers. About seven of us. We correspond.
Mm-hmm. You really do?
We have a newsletter.
It goes like this.
You know what that takes. I'll tell you what it takes. First of all, it's very deceptive. When you see it done, it probably looks quite, you know, really wild, pretty grotesque. But a lot of people do not, when they try it, they quickly realize in about 30 or 40 seconds that it takes insane concentration. That's the real thing, concentration. And also, you have to have an ear, of course, as well as a very talented head. Many are born with heads, but few are chosen. This is the way it works. But how'd it sound in there, Candy?
Beautiful.
Great. Can you do... would you like to hear a little of it?
Well, I've heard it before, but if you care to, sure. What does it sound like to you, Candy? I'm just curious.
It sounded like a musical instrument I'd never heard before. It was an instrument.
Well, now, I'm going to tell you something that may surprise you, and it is a fact. Do you know that composers in the late 17th century and early 18th century did write for Kopfspielen? Kopfspielen, of course, is the German word meaning head. Head singing.
Head singing.
Head music.
Head talking.
Head music, really. And there was a very famous Kopfspieler who traveled, in fact, had music written for him. I believe that even Beethoven wrote a piece for him. He traveled all throughout Europe and was a highly regarded concert performer. And, of course, that instrument, and it is an instrument, that instrument still persists in certain places in the world. How I got involved in it is a long, dull story. But I started this when I was a kid. Actually did.
Mm-hmm.
He's got this queued up. And
do you want to hear it? Now, you see, before he plays this, I have to explain something to you. This is not really the kind of music I would have used. And John went back and just picked this out of the library, just pulled something out. I'd never heard this before. And like anything else, if I worked on it, then...
You couldn't have made it more beautiful.
Yes, indeed. You'd be surprised what work does. In fact, when we did it in the review, it was actually a concert piece. I had a small group composed of a cornet, believe it or not, a lute, and a lute, a snare drum, and a violin. They were really a strange group, and they were playing in behind the curtain, and this is what I did in the review, and they played this behind the curtain, and I played a one-minute etude by Chopin on the head. It was fantastic.
Which
used to bring
one was,
the house.
Do you recall?
I don't recall now, but it was a yes. Chopin etude. It took about 65 seconds to play, but we did it without any warning. All of a sudden, I broke into this thing. In the middle of a wild scene with blue lights on, it was very avant-garde review and just brought the house down. But can you hear this now?
Yes, please.
Okay. Just so you hear it.
Yeah.
Shepard playing on his head. Candy and I are sitting in here now just reviewing it once more. And it is really great. Maybe we could find one more later. First, we have to... he's right now putting Need's Foot oil on his head.
Always carry it with me.
Yes. And...
what kind of oil?
Need's Foot. Haven't you ever used it on your boots?
No, I don't...
You're kidding me.
No, I use saddle soap.
Well, that's for cleaning.
Well, it's for softening and...
Well, no, Need's Foot oil is the...
That's the real thing. Need's
Foot
oil.
The real thing.
It's
on your saddle and all?
No.
Well, actually, mostly outfielders use it. It's
on the glove.
On the glove.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Need's Foot. N-E-A-T-S.
Yes, yes.
Is this? Isn't that the spelling?
N-E-E-T-S. Need's Foot.
Oh, yeah, that's right. N-E-E-T-S.
What?
Yeah.
Need's
right,
foot. Yeah, yeah, because the kids used to have it, that's right, for
right.
their baseball yeah. mitts.
And the Need's Foot that I use is the head Need's Foot, which contains lanolin.
Yes.
They do have it for
it
you?
It also curbs dandruff.
Yeah.
And, yes, I rub it into my head every night, and I keep the head soft and pliable.
Yeah. Very important because he's playing a C melody. You see, in reed instruments... You have the alto horn, you have the tenor horn, and you have the C melody. And that's what Rupert plays,
that's
is
right.
C melody.
All right, that's right.
Yeah. Very difficult to keep in tune a C melody reed instrument. They'll either play it straight or as a miniature saxophone. And Wilbert plays this in the world's greatest jazz band.
Sidney Bechet plays.
Well, he studied with Sidney Bechet.
Yeah, great C melody
player. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
And I'm not being facetious. I'm not trying to be funny. But could your head go out of tune?
It certainly can if it's not taken care of properly. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. You see, a C melody,
yeah.
which you don't understand. In other words, if you were or E flat alto horn. It stays in tune if you know how to blow this reed instrument. But for some reason, a soprano sax, it's called a soprano instrument, or the C melody. And this has a tendency of going out of tune while you're playing. So you,
right in the middle of a
you have to compensate for that immediately. I mean, you can't say to the audience, let's start from the top because my instrument went out
right.
of tune.
Yeah.
And that's the toughest... One, that's why I never realized he was C melody. I automatically thought he was possibly E flat alto. But he isn't. It's the toughest tuning to keep in...
Now, if I didn't keep my head in shape, it would slip down to an E flat alto.
Yes.
And, of course, at that point, I'd have to play an entirely different repertoire of music. And it's not quite as dramatic. The C melody is a very dramatic instrument.
And we are not kidding you, Candy. This is not a put on because
no.
you watched him.
I know.
And you saw him play. And right now,